Mr. Segundus told his dream to Mr. Honeyfoot.
"What a remarkably magical spot," said Mr. Honeyfoot approvingly. "Your dream, so full of odd symbols and portents, is yet another proof of it."
"But what does it mean?" asked Mr. Segundus.
"Oh,"
said Mr. Honeyfoot, and stopped to think a while.
"Well, the lady wore blue, you say. Blue signifies, let me see, immortality, chastity and fidelity. It stands for Jupiter and can be represented by tin." "Now, where does that get us?"
"Nowhere, I think," sighed Mr. Segundus. "Let us walk on." Mr. Honeyfoot, who was anxious to see more, quickly agreed to this proposal and suggested that they explore the interior of the Shadow House. In the fierce sunlight, the house was no more than a towering green-blue haze against the sky. As they passed through the doorway to the great hall,
"Oh!" cried Mr. Segundus. "Why, what is it now?"
asked Mr. Honeyfoot, startled. Upon either side of the doorway stood a stone image of the Raven King.
"I saw these in my dream," said Mr. Segundus.
In the great hall, Mr. Segundus looked about him. The mirrors and the paintings that he had seen in his dream were long since gone. Lilac and elder trees filled up the broken walls. Horse chestnuts and ash made a roof of green and silver that flowed and dappled against the blue sky. Fine gold grasses and ragged robin made a latticework for the empty stone windows. At one end of the room, there were two indistinct figures in a blaze of sunlight. A few odd items were scattered about the floor, a kind of magical debris. Some pieces of paper with scraps of spells scribbled upon them, a silver basin full of water, and a half-burnt candle in an ancient brass candlestick. Mr. Honeyfoot wished these two shadowy figures a good morning, and one replied to him in grave and civil tones, but the other cried out upon the instant,
"Henry, it is he! That is the fellow! That is the very man I described! Do you not see? A small man with hair and eyes so dark as to be almost Italian, though the hair has grey in it, but the expression so quiet and timid as to be English without a doubt. A shabby coat all dusty and patched, with frayed cuffs that he has tried to hide by snipping them close. Oh, Henry, this is certainly the man. You, sir," he cried, suddenly addressing Mr. Segundus, "explain yourself."
Poor Mr. Segundus was very much astonished to hear himself and his coat so minutely described by a complete stranger, and the description itself of such a peculiarly distressing sort, not at all polite. As he stood, trying to collect his thoughts, his interlocutor moved into the shade of an ash tree that formed part of the north wall of the hall, and for the first time in the waking world, Mr. Segundus beheld Jonathan Strange. Somewhat hesitantly, for he was aware, as he said it, how strangely it sounded, Mr. Segundus said,
"I have seen you, sir, in my dream, I think."
This only enraged Strange more.
"The dream, sir, was mine. I lay down on purpose to dream it. I can bring proofs, witnesses, that the dream was mine.
Mr. Woodhope," he indicated his companion, "saw me do it. Mr. Woodhope is a clergyman, the rector of a parish in Gloucestershire. I cannot imagine that his word could be doubted. I am rather of the opinion that in England a gentleman's dreams are his own private concern. I fancy there is a law to that effect, and if there is not, why, Parliament should certainly be made to pass one immediately. It ill becomes another man to invite himself into them." Strange paused to take breath.
"Sir," cried Mr. Honeyfoot hotly, "I must beg you to speak to this gentleman with more respect. You have not the good fortune to know this gentleman as I do, but should you have that honour, you will learn that nothing is further from his character than a wish to offend others."
Strange made a sort of exclamation of exasperation.
"It is certainly very odd that people should get into each other's dreams," said Henry Woodhope. "Surely it cannot really have been the same dream."
"Oh, but I fear it is," said Mr. Segundus with a sigh.
"Ever since I entered this garden, I have felt as if it were full of invisible doors, and I have gone through them one after the other until I fell asleep and dreamt the dream where I saw this gentleman. I was in a greatly confused state of mind. I knew it was not me that had set these doors ajar and made them to open, but I did not care. I only wanted to see what was at the end of them."
Henry Woodhope gazed at Mr. Segundus as if he did not entirely understand this.
But I still think it cannot be the same dream, you know, he explained to Mr. Segundus, as if to a rather stupid child. What did you dream of?
Of a lady in a blue gown, said Mr. Segundus. I suppose that it was Miss Absalom.
Well, of course it was Miss Absalom, cried Strange in great exasperation, as if he could scarcely bear to hear anything so obvious mentioned. But unfortunately, the lady's appointment was to meet one gentleman. She was naturally disturbed to find two, and so she promptly disappeared. Strange shook his head. There cannot be more than 5 men in England with any pretensions to magic, but one of them must come here and interrupt my meeting with Absalom's daughter. I can scarcely believe it. I am the unluckiest man in England. God knows I have laboured long enough to dream that dream. It has taken me 3 weeks, working night and day to prepare the spells of summoning, and as for the—
But this is marvellous, interrupted Mr. Honeyfoot. This is wonderful. Why, not even Mr. Norrell himself could attempt such a thing.
Oh, said Strange, turning to Mr. Honeyfoot. It is not so difficult as you imagine. At first, you must send out your invitation to the lady. Any spell of summoning will do. I used Ormskirk.
Footnote 3. Paris Ormskirk, 1496 to 1587, a schoolmaster from the village of Clerkenwell near London. He wrote several treatises on magic. Though no very original thinker, he was a diligent worker who set himself the task of assembling and sifting through all the spells of summoning he could find, to try to uncover one reliable version. This took him 12 years, during which time his little house on Clerkenwell Green filled up with thousands of small pieces of paper with spells written on them. Mrs. Ormskirk was not best pleased, and she, poor woman, became the original of the magician's wife in stock comedies and second-rate novels, a strident, scolding, unhappy person. The spell that Ormskirk eventually produced became very popular, and was widely used in his own century and the two following ones. But until Jonathan Strange made his own alterations to the spell, and brought forth Maria Absalom into his own dream, and Mr. Segundus's, I never heard of anyone who had the least success with it, perhaps for the reasons that Jonathan Strange gives. Of course, the troublesome part was to adapt Ormskirk so that both Miss Absalom and I arrived in my dream at the same time. Ormskirk is so loose that the person one summons might go pretty well anywhere at any time and feel that they had fulfilled their obligations. That, I admit, was not an easy task. And yet, you know, I'm not displeased with the results. Second, I had to cast a spell upon myself to bring on a magic sleep. Of course, I have heard of such spells, but confess that I have never actually seen one. And so, you know, I was obliged to invent my own. I dare say it is feeble enough, but what can one do?
Good God, cried Mr. Honeyfoot. Do you mean to say that practically all this magic was your own invention?
Oh, well, said Strange, as to that, I had Ormskirk. I based everything on Ormskirk.
Oh, but might not Heather Grey be a better foundation than Ormskirk? Asked Mr. Segundus.
Footnote 4. Mr. Segundus's good sense seems to have deserted him at this point. Charles Heather Grey, 1712 to 89, was another historio-magician who published a famous spell of summoning. His spell and Ormskirk's are equally bad. There is not a pin to choose between them.
Forgive me, I'm no practical magician, but Heather Grey has always seemed to me so much more reliable than Ormskirk.
Indeed, said Strange.
Of course I have heard of Heather Grey. I have recently begun to correspond with a gentleman in Lincolnshire who says he has a copy of Heather Grey's The Anatomy of a Minotaur. So Heather Grey is really worth looking into, is he?
Mr. Honeyfoot declared that Heather Grey was no such thing, that his book was the most thick-headed nonsense in the world. Mr. Segundus disagreed, and Strange grew more interested and less mindful of the fact that he was supposed to be angry with Mr. Segundus. For who can remain angry with Mr. Segundus? I dare say there are people in the world who are able to resent goodness and amiability, whose spirits are irritated by gentleness. But I'm glad to say that Jonathan Strange was not of their number. Mr. Segundus offered his apologies for spoiling the magic, and Strange, with a smile and a bow, said that Mr. Segundus should think of it no more.
I shall not ask, sir, said Strange to Mr. Segundus, if you are a magician. The ease with which you penetrate other people's dreams proclaims your power.
Strange turned to Mr. Honeyfoot.
But are you a magician also, sir? Poor Mr. Honeyfoot. So blunt a question to be applied to so tender a spot. He was still a magician at heart, and did not like to be reminded of his loss. He replied that he had been a magician not so many years before, but he had been obliged to give it up. Nothing could have been further from his own wishes. The study of magic, of good English magic, was, in his opinion, the most noble occupation in the world. Strange regarded him with some surprise. But I do not very well comprehend you. How could anyone make you give up your studies if you did not wish it? Then Mr. Segundus and Mr. Honeyfoot described how they had been members of the Learned Society of York Magicians, and how the society had been destroyed by Mr. Norrell. Mr. Honeyfoot asked Strange for his opinion of Mr. Norrell. Oh, said Strange with a smile, Mr. Norrell is the patron saint of English booksellers.
Sir? Said Mr. Honeyfoot.
Oh, said Strange, one hears of Mr. Norrell in every place where the book trade is perpetrated, from Newcastle to Penzance. The bookseller smiles and bows and says, Ah, sir, you are come too late. I had a great many books upon subjects of magical and historical, but I sold them all to a very learned gentleman of Yorkshire. It is always Norrell. One may buy, if one chooses, the books that Norrell has left behind. I generally find that the books that Mr. Norrell leaves behind are really excellent things for lighting fires with. Mr. Segundus and Mr. Honeyfoot were naturally all eagerness to be better acquainted with Jonathan Strange, and he seemed just as anxious to talk to them. Consequently, after each side had made and answered the usual inquiries, Where are you staying?
Oh, the George in Avebury.
Well, that is remarkable. So are we. It was quickly decided that all four gentlemen should ride back to Avebury and dine together. As they left the Shadow House, Strange paused by the Raven King doorway and asked if either Mr. Segundus or Mr. Honeyfoot had visited the King's ancient capital of Newcastle in the north. Neither had. This door is a copy of one you'll find upon every corner there, said Strange. The first in this fashion were made when the King was still in England. In that city, it seems that everywhere you turn, the King steps out of some dark, dusty archway and comes toward you. Strange smiled wryly. But his face is always half hidden, and he will never speak to you. At 5 o'clock, they sat down to dinner in the parlour of the George Inn. Mr. Honeyfoot and Mr. Segundus found Strange to be a most agreeable companion, lively and talkative. Henry Woodhope, on the other hand, ate diligently, and when he was done eating, he looked out of the window. Mr. Segundus feared that he might feel himself neglected, and so he turned to him and complimented him upon the magic that Strange had done at the Shadow House. Henry Woodhope was surprised. I had not supposed it was a matter for congratulation, he said. Strange did not say it was anything remarkable. But my dear sir, exclaimed Mr. Segundus, who knows when such a feat was last attempted in England? Oh, I know nothing of magic. I believe it is quite the fashionable thing. I've seen reports of magic in the London papers. But a clergyman has little leisure for reading. Besides, I've known Strange since we were boys, and he is of a most capricious character. I'm surprised this magical fit has lasted so long. I dare say he will soon tire of it, as he has of everything else. With that, he rose from the table and said he thought he would walk about the village for a while. He bade Mr. Honeyfoot and Mr. Segundus a good evening and left them. Poor Henry, said Strange, when Mr. Woodhope had gone. I suppose we must bore him horribly. It is most good-natured of your friend to accompany you on your journey, when he himself can have no interest in its object, said Mr. Honeyfoot. Oh, certainly, said Strange. But then, you know, he was forced to come with me when he found it so quiet at home. Henry is paying us a visit of some weeks, but ours is a very retired neighbourhood, and I believe I am a great deal taken up with my studies. Mr. Segundus asked Mr. Strange when he began to study magic. In the spring of last year.
But you have achieved so much, cried Mr. Honeyfoot, and in less than 2 years. My dear Mr. Strange, it is quite remarkable.
Oh, do you think so? It seems to me that I have hardly done anything. But then I have not known where to turn for advice. You're the first of my brother magicians that I ever met with, and I give you fair warning that I intend to make you sit up half the night answering questions.
We shall be delighted to help you in any way we can, said Mr. Segundus. But I very much doubt that we can be of much service to you. We have only ever been theoretical magicians.
You are much too modest, declared Strange. Consider, for example, how much more extensive your reading has been than mine. So Mr. Segundus began to suggest authors whom Strange might not yet have heard of, and Strange began to scribble down their names and works in a somewhat haphazard fashion, sometimes writing in a little memorandum book, and other times writing upon the back of the dinner bill, and once upon the back of his hand. Then he began to question Mr. Segundus about the books. Poor Mr. Honeyfoot, how he longed to take part in this interesting conversation. How, in fact, he did take part in it, deceiving no one but himself by his little stratagems.
Tell him he must read Thomas Lanchester's The Language of Birds, he said, addressing Mr. Secundus rather than Strange. Oh, he said, I know you have no opinion of it, but I think one may learn many things from Lanchester.
Whereupon Mr. Strange told them how, to his certain knowledge, there had been 4 copies of The Language of Birds in England not more than 5 years ago, one in a Gloucester bookseller's, one in the private library of a gentleman magician in Kendal, one the property of a blacksmith near Penzance, who had taken it in part payment for mending an iron gate, and one stopping a gap in a window of the boys' school in the close of Durham Cathedral.
But where are they now? Cried Mr. Honeyfoot. Why did you not purchase a copy?
By the time that I came to each place, Norrell had got there before me. And bought them all, said Mr. Strange. I never laid eyes upon the man, and yet he thwarts me at every turn. That is why I hit upon this plan of summoning up some dead magician and asking him, or her, questions. I fancied a lady might be more sympathetic to my plight, and so I chose Miss Absalom. Footnote 5. In medieval times, conjuring the dead was a well-known sort of magic, and there seems to have been a consensus that a dead magician was both the easiest spirit to raise and the most worth talking to. Mr. Segundus shook his head.
As a means of getting knowledge, it strikes me as more dramatic than convenient. Can you not think of an easier way? After all, in the golden age of English magic, books were much rarer than they are now, yet men still became magicians.
I have studied histories and biographies of the Oriots to discover how they began, said Strange. But it seems that in those days, as soon as anyone found out that he had some aptitude for magic, he immediately set off for the house of some other older, more experienced magician, and offered himself as a pupil. Footnote 6. There have been very few magicians who did not learn magic from another practitioner. The Raven King was not the first British magician. There have been others before him, notably the 7th century half-man, half-demon Merlin. But at the time the Raven King came into England, there were none. A little enough is known about the Raven King's early years, but it is reasonable to suppose that he learnt both magic and kingship at the court of a king of faery. Early magicians in medieval England learnt their art at the court of the Raven King, and these magicians trained others. One exception may be the Nottinghamshire magician Thomas Godbless, 1105 to 82. Most of his life is entirely obscure to us. He certainly spent some time with the Raven King, but this seems to have been late in his life, when he had already been a magician for years. He is perhaps one example that a magician may be self-created, as, of course, were both Gilbert Norrell and Jonathan Strange.
Then you should apply to Mr. Norrell for assistance, cried Mr. Honeyfoot. Indeed you should. Oh, yes, I know,
seeing that Mr. Segundus was about to make an objection.
Norrell is a little reserved, but what is that? Mr. Strange will know how to overcome his timidity, I'm sure. For all his faults of temper, Norrell is no fool, and must see the very great advantages of having such an assistant.
Mr. Segundus had many objections to the scheme, in particular Mr. Norrell's great aversion to other magicians. But Mr. Honeyfoot, with all the enthusiasm of his eager disposition, had no sooner conceived the idea than it became a favourite wish, and he could not suppose there would be any drawbacks.
Oh, I agree, he said, that Norrell has never looked very favourably upon us theoretical magicians, but I dare say he will behave quite differently towards an equal.
Strange himself did not seem at all adverse to the idea. He had a natural curiosity to see Mr. Norrell. Indeed, Mr. Segundus could not help suspecting that he had already made up his mind upon the point, and so Mr. Segundus gradually allowed his doubts and objections to be argued down.
This is a great day for Great Britain, sir, cried Mr. Honeyfoot. Look at all that one magician has been able to accomplish. Only consider what 2 might do. Strange and Norrell. Oh, it sounds very well.
Then Mr. Honeyfoot repeated, Strange and Norrell, several times over, in a highly delighted manner, that made Strange laugh very much. But like many gentle characters, Mr. Segundus was much given to changes of mind. As long as Mr. Strange stood before him, tall, smiling, and assured, Mr. Segundus had every confidence that Strange's genius must receive the recognition it deserved, whether it be with Mr. Norrell's help or in spite of Mr. Norrell's hindrance. But the next morning, after Strange and Henry Woodhope had ridden off, his thoughts returned to all the magicians whom Mr. Norrell had labored to destroy, and he began to wonder if Mr. Honeyfoot and he might not have misled Strange. I cannot help thinking, he said, that we should have done a great deal better to warn Mr. Strange to avoid Mr. Norrell. Rather than encouraging him to seek out Norrell, we should have advised him to hide himself. But Mr. Honeyfoot did not understand this at all.
No gentleman likes to be told to hide, he said, and if Mr. Norrell should mean any harm to Mr. Strange, which I am very far from allowing to be the case, then I am sure that Mr. Strange will be the first to find it out.
Chapter 24 Another Magician September 1809
Mr. Drawlight turned slightly in his chair, smiled and said,
It seems, sir, that you have a rival.
Before Mr. Norrell could think of a suitable reply, Lascelles asked what was the man's name.
Strange, said Drawlight.
I do not know him, said Lascelles.
Oh, cried Drawlight. I think you must. Jonathan Strange of Shropshire. £2,000 a year?
I have not the least idea whom you mean. Oh, but wait. Is not this the man who, when an undergraduate at Cambridge, frightened a cat belonging to the master of Corpus Christi?
Drawlight agreed that this was the very man. Lascelles knew him instantly, and they both laughed. Meanwhile, Mr. Norrell sat silent as a stone. Drawlight's opening remark had been a terrible blow. He felt as if Drawlight had turned and struck him, as if a figure in a painting or a table or a chair had turned and struck him. The shock of it had almost taken his breath away. He was quite certain he would be ill. What Drawlight might say next, Mr. Norrell dared not think. Something of greater powers, perhaps? Of wonders performed beside which Mr. Norrell's own would appear pitiful indeed? And he had taken such pains to ensure there could be no rivals. He felt like the man who goes about his house at night, locking doors and barring windows, only to hear the certain sounds of someone walking about in an upstairs room. But as the conversation progressed, these unpleasant sensations lessened, and Mr. Norrell began to feel more comfortable. As Drawlight and Lascelles talked of Mr. Strange's Brighton pleasure trips and visits to Bath, and Mr. Strange's estate in Shropshire, Mr. Norrell thought he understood the sort of man this Strange must be. A fashionable, shallow sort of man, a man not unlike Lascelles himself. That being so, said Mr. Norrell to himself, was it not more probable that You have a rival, was addressed not to himself, but to Lascelles. This Strange, thought Mr. Norrell, must be Lascelles's rival in some love affair or other. Norrell looked down at his hands, clasped in his lap, and smiled at his own folly.
And so, said Lascelles, Strange is now a magician. Oh, said Drawlight, turning to Mr. Norrell. I am sure that not even his greatest friends would compare his talents to those of the estimable Mr. Norrell. But I believe he is well enough thought of in Bristol and Bath. He is in London at present. His friends hope that you will be kind enough to grant him an interview. And may I express a wish to be present when two such practitioners of the art meet?
Mr. Norrell lifted his eyes very slowly.
I shall be happy to meet Mr. Strange, he said.
Mr. Drawlight was not made to wait long before he witnessed the momentous interview between the two magicians, which was just as well, for Mr. Drawlight hated to wait. An invitation was issued, and both Lascelles and Drawlight made it their business to be present when Mr. Strange waited upon Mr. Norrell. He proved neither as young nor as handsome as Mr. Norrell had feared. He was nearer 30 than 20, and as far as another gentleman may be permitted to judge these things, not handsome at all. But what was very unexpected was that he brought with him a pretty young woman, Mrs. Strange. Mr. Narrow began by asking Strange if he had brought his writing. He would, he said, very much like to read what Mr. Strange had written.
My writing, said Strange, and paused a moment.
I'm afraid, sir, that I'm at a loss to know what you mean. I have written nothing.
Oh, said Mr. Norrell. Mr. Drawlight told me that you had been asked to write something for the Gentleman's Magazine, but perhaps—
Oh, that, said Strange. I've scarcely thought about it. Nichols assured me he did not need it until Friday after next.
A week on Friday and not yet begun? Said Mr. Norrell, very much astonished.
Oh, said Strange. I think that the quicker one gets these things out of one's brain, and onto the paper and off to the printers, the better. I dare say, sir, and he smiled at Mr. Norrell in a friendly manner, that you find the same. Mr. Norrell, who had never yet got anything successfully out of his brain and off to the printers, whose every attempt was still at some stage or other of revision, said nothing. As to what I shall write, continued Strange, I do not quite know yet, but it will most likely be a refutation of Portishead's article in The Modern Magician. Footnote 1. The Modern Magician was one of several magical periodicals set up following the first appearance of the Friends of English Magic in 1808. Though not appointed by Mr. Norrell, the editors of these periodicals never dreamt of deviating from orthodox magical opinion as laid down by Mr. Norrell.
Did you see it, sir? It put me in a rage for a week.
He sought to prove that modern magicians have no business in dealing with fairies. It's one thing to admit that we have lost the power to raise such spirits. It's quite another to renounce all intention of ever employing them. I have no patience with any such squeamishness. But what is most extraordinary is that I've yet to see any criticism of Portishead's article anywhere. Now that we have something approaching a magical community, I think we would be very wrong to let such thick-headed nonsense pass unreproved. Strange, apparently thinking that he had talked enough, waited for one of the other gentlemen to reply. After a moment or two of silence, Mr. Lascelles remarked that Lord Portishead had written the article at Mr. Norrell's express wish, and with Mr. Norrell's aid and approval.
Indeed?
Strange looked very much astonished. There was a silence of some moments, and then Lascelles languidly inquired how one learnt magic these days.
From books, said Strange.
Ah, sir, cried Mr. Norrell, how glad I am to hear you say so. Waste no time, I implore you, in pursuing any other course, but apply yourself constantly to reading. No sacrifice of time or pleasure can ever be too great.
Strange regarded Mr. Norrell somewhat ironically, and then remarked, unfortunately, lack of books has always been a great obstacle. I dare say you have no conception, sir, how few books of magic there are left in circulation in England. All the booksellers agree that a few years ago there were a great many. But now—
Indeed, interrupted Mr. Norrell hurriedly. Well, that is very odd, to be sure.
The silence which followed was peculiarly awkward. Here sat the only two English magicians of the modern age. One confessed he had no books, the other, as was well known, had two great libraries stuffed with them. Mere common politeness seemed to dictate that Mr. Norrell make some offer of help, however slight. But Mr. Norrell said nothing.
It must have been a very curious circumstance, said Mr. Lascelles, after a while, that made you choose to be a magician.
It was, said Strange. Most curious. Will you not tell us what that circumstance was?
Strange smiled maliciously.
I am sure that it will give Mr. Norrell great pleasure to know that he was the cause of my becoming a magician. One might say, in fact, that Mr. Norrell made me a magician.
I? Cried Mr. Norrell, quite horrified.
The truth is, sir, said Arabella Strange quickly, that he had tried everything else, farming, poetry, iron founding. In the course of a year, he ran through a whole variety of occupations without settling to any of them. He was bound to come to magic, sooner or later.
There was another silence.
Then Strange said, I had not understood before that Lord Portishead wrote at your behest, sir. Perhaps you will be so good as to explain something to me. I have read all of his lordship's essays in The Friends of English Magic and The Modern Magician, but have yet to see any mention of the Raven King. The omission is so striking that I am beginning to think it must be deliberate.
Mr. Norrell nodded.
It is one of my ambitions to make that man as completely forgotten as he deserves, he said.
But surely, sir, without the Raven King, there would be no magic, and no magicians.
That is the common opinion, certainly. But even if it were true, which I am very far from allowing, he has long since forfeited any entitlement to our esteem. For what were his first actions upon coming into England? To make war upon England's lawful king, and rob him of half his kingdom. And shall you and I, Mr. Strange, let it be known that we have chosen such a man as our model? That we account him the first among us? Will that make our profession respected? Will that persuade the king's ministers to put their trust in us? I do not think so. No, Mr. Strange, if we cannot make his name forgotten, then it is our duty, yours and mine, to broadcast our hatred of him, to let it be known everywhere our great abhorrence of his corrupt nature and evil deeds.
It was clear that a great disparity of views and temper existed between the two magicians, and Arabella Strange seemed to think there was no occasion for them to continue any longer in the same room to irritate each other more. She and Strange left very shortly afterwards. Naturally, Mr. Drawlight was the first to pronounce upon the new magician.
"Well," he said, rather before the door had closed upon Strange's back, "I do not know what may be your opinion, but I never was more astonished in my life. I was informed by several people that he was a handsome man. What could they have meant, do you suppose? With such a nose as he has got, and that hair, reddish-brown, is such a fickle colour. There is no wear in it. I am quite certain I saw some grey in it. And yet he cannot be more than, what, 30, 32, perhaps? She, on the other hand, is quite delightful. So much animation. Those brown curls so sweetly arranged. But I thought it a great pity that she had not taken more trouble to inform herself of the London fashions. The sprigged muslin she had on was certainly very pretty, but I should like to see her wear something altogether more stylish. Say, forest green silk trimmed with black ribbons and black bugle beads. That's only a first thought, you understand. I may be struck with quite a different idea when I see her again. Do you think that people will be curious about him? Asked Mr. Norrell.
Oh, certainly, said Mr. Lascelles.
Ah, said Mr. Norrell, then I am very much afraid. Mr. Lascelles, I would be very glad if you could advise me. I am very much afraid that Lord Mulgrave may send for Mr. Strange. His lordship's zeal for using magic in the war, excellent in itself, of course, has had the unfortunate effect of encouraging him to read all sorts of books on magical history and forming opinions about what he finds there. He has devised a plan to summon up witches to aid me in defeating the French. I believe he's thinking of those half-fairy, half-human women to whom malicious people were used to apply when they wished to harm their neighbours. The sort of witches, in short, that Shakespeare describes in Macbeth. He asked me to invoke 3 or 4, and was not best pleased that I refused to do it. Modern magic can do many things, but summoning up witches could bring a world of trouble upon everyone's head. But now I fear he might send for Mr. Strange instead. Mr. Lascelles, do not you think that he might? And then Mr. Strange might try it, not understanding anything of the danger. Perhaps it would be as well to write to Sir Walter, asking if he would be so good as to have a word in his lordship's ear to warn him against Mr. Strange.
Oh, said Lascelles, I see no occasion for that. If you think that Mr. Strange's magic is not safe, then it will soon get about.
Later in the day, a dinner was given in Mr. Norrell's honour at a house in Great Titchfield Street, at which Mr. Drawlight and Mr. Lascelles were also present. It was not long before Mr. Norrell was asked to give his opinion of the Shropshire magician.
Mr. Strange, said Mr. Norrell, seems a very pleasant gentleman, and a very talented magician, who may yet be a most creditable addition to our profession, which has certainly been somewhat depleted of late.
Mr. Strange appears to entertain some very odd notions of magic, said Lascelles.
He has not troubled to inform himself of the modern ideas on the subject, by which I mean, of course, Mr. Norrell's ideas, which have so astonished the world with their clarity and succinctness. Mr. Drawlight repeated his opinion that Mr. Strange's red hair had no wear in it, and that Mrs. Strange's gown, though not exactly fashionable, had been of very pretty muslin. At about the same time that this conversation was taking place,
another set of people, among them Mr. and Mrs. Strange, were sitting down to dinner in a more modest dining parlour in a house in Charterhouse Square. Mr. and Mrs. Strange's friends were naturally anxious to know their opinion of the great Mr. Norrell. "He says he hopes that the Raven King will soon be forgot," said Strange in amazement. "What do you make of that? A magician who hopes the Raven King will soon be forgot. If the Archbishop of Canterbury were discovered to be working secretly to suppress all knowledge of the Trinity, it would make as much sense to me. He is like a musician who wishes to conceal the music of Mr. Handel," agreed a lady in a turban, eating artichokes with almonds.
"Or a fishmonger who hopes to persuade people that the sea does not exist," said a gentleman, helping himself to a large piece of mullet in a good wine sauce.
Then other people proposed similar examples of folly, and everyone laughed, except Strange, who sat frowning at his dinner.
"I thought you meant to ask Mr. Norrell to help you," said Arabella.
"Well, how could I, when he seemed to be quarrelling from the first moment we met?" cried Strange.
"He does not like me."
"Nor I him."
"Not like you?"
"No, perhaps he did not like you, but he did not so much as look at any other person the whole time you were there. It was as if he would eat you up with his eyes. I dare say he's lonely. He has studied all these years and never had anybody he could explain his mind to. Certainly not to those disagreeable men. I forget their names. But now that he has seen you and he knows that he could talk to you, well, it would be very odd if he did not invite you again."
In Great Titchfield Street, Mr. Norrell put down his fork and dabbed at his lips with a napkin.
"Of course," he said, "he must apply himself. I urged him to apply himself."
Strange in Charterhouse Square said, "He told me to apply myself." "To what?" I asked. "To reading," he said. I was never more astonished in my life. I was very near asking him what I was supposed to read when he has all the books. The next day, Strange told Arabella that they could go back to Shropshire any time she pleased. He did not think that there was anything to keep them in London. He also said that he had resolved to think no more about Mr. Norrell. In this, he was not entirely successful, for several times in the next few days, Arabella found herself listening to a long recital of all Mr. Norrell's faults, both professional and personal. Meanwhile, in Hanover Square, Mr. Norrell constantly inquired of Mr. Drawlight what Mr. Strange was doing, whom he visited, and what people thought of him. Mr. Lascelles and Mr. Drawlight were a little alarmed at this development. For more than a year now, they had enjoyed no small degree of influence over the magician, and, as his friends, they were courted by admirals, generals, politicians, anyone, in fact, who wished to know Mr. Norrell's opinion upon this or wished Mr. Norrell to do that. The thought of another magician who might attach himself to Mr. Norrell by closer ties than Drawlight or Lascelles could ever hope to forge, who might take upon himself the task of advising Mr. Norrell, was very disagreeable. Mr. Drawlight told Mr. Lascelles that Norrell should be discouraged from thinking of the Shropshire magician, and though Mr. Lascelles' whimsical nature never permitted him to agree outright with anyone, there is little doubt that he thought the same. But 3 or 4 days after Mr. Strange's visit, Mr. Norrell said,
"I've been considering the matter very carefully, and I believe that something ought to be done for Mr. Strange. He complained of his lack of materials. Well, of course, I can see that that might... In short, I have decided to make him a present of a book."
"But, sir," cried Drawlight, "your precious books! You must not give them away to other people, especially to other magicians who may not use them as wisely as yourself."
"Oh," said Mr. Norrell, "I do not mean one of my own books. I fear I could not spare a single one. No, I have purchased a volume from Edwards and Skittering to give Mr. Strange, and the choice was, I confess, a difficult one. There are many books which, to be perfectly frank, I would not be quite comfortable in recommending to Mr. Strange. Yet. He is not ready for them. He would imbibe all sorts of wrong ideas from them. This book," Mr. Norrell looked at it in an anxious sort of way, "has many faults. I fear it has a great many. Mr. Strange will learn no actual magic from it. But it has a great deal to say on the subjects of diligent research and the perils of committing oneself to paper too soon. Lessons which I hope Mr. Strange may take to heart."
So Mr. Norrell invited Strange to Hanover Square again, and as on the previous occasion, Drawlight and Lascelles were present. But Strange,
came alone. The second meeting took place in the library at Hanover Square. Strange looked about him at the great quantities of books, but said not a word. Perhaps he had got to the end of his anger. There seemed to be a determination on both sides to speak and behave more cordially. "You do me great honour, sir," said Strange, when Mr. Norrell gave him his present. "English Magic by Jeremy Tott." He turned the pages. "Not an author I have ever heard of."
"It is a biography of his brother, a theoretical magio-historian of the last century called Horace Tott," said Mr. Norrell.
Footnote 2. Horace Tott spent an uneventful life in Cheshire, always intending to write a large book on English magic, but never quite beginning. And so he died at 74, still imagining he might begin next week, or perhaps the week after that. He explained about the lessons of diligent research and not committing oneself to paper that Strange was to learn. Strange smiled politely, bowed, and said he was sure it would be most interesting. Mr. Drawlight admired Strange's present. Mr. Norrell gazed at Strange with an odd expression upon his face, as though he would have been glad of a little conversation with him, but had not the least idea how to begin. Mr. Lascelles reminded Mr. Norrell that Lord Mulgrave of the Admiralty was expected within the hour. "You have business to conduct, sir," said Strange. "I must not intrude. Indeed, I have business for Mrs. Strange in Bond Street. That must not be neglected."
"And perhaps one day," said Drawlight, "we shall have the honour of seeing a piece of magic worked by Mr. Strange. I am excessively fond of seeing magic done."
"Perhaps," said Strange. Mr. Lascelles rang the bell for the servant. Suddenly, Mr. Norrell said, "I should be glad to see some of Mr. Strange's magic now, if he would honour us with a demonstration." "Oh," said Strange, "but I do not—"
"It would do me great honour," insisted Mr. Norrell.
"Very well," said Strange. "I shall be very glad to show you something. It will be a little awkward, perhaps, compared to what you're accustomed to. I very much doubt, Mr. Norrell, that I can match you in elegance of execution." Mr. Norrell bowed. Strange glanced two or three times around the room in search of some magic to do. His glance fell upon a mirror that hung in the depths of a corner of the room where the light never penetrated. He placed English Magic by Jeremy Tott upon the library table, so that its reflection was clearly visible in the mirror. For some moments he stared at it, and nothing happened. And then he made a curious gesture. He ran both hands through his hair, clasped the back of his neck, and stretched his shoulders, as a man will do who eases himself of the cramps. Then he smiled, and altogether looked exceedingly pleased with himself. Which was odd, because the book looked exactly as it had done before. Lascelles and Drawlight, who were both accustomed to seeing or hearing about Mr. Norrell's wonderful magic, were scarcely impressed by this. Indeed, it was a great deal less than a common conjurer might manage at a fairground. Lascelles opened his mouth, doubtless to say some scathing thing, but was forestalled by Mr. Norrell suddenly crying out in a tone of wonder,
"But that is remarkable. That is truly, oh, my dear Mr. Strange, I never even heard of such magic before. It is not listed in Sutton Grove, I assure you, my dear sir. It is not in Sutton Grove."
Lascelles and Drawlight looked from one magician to the other in some confusion. Lascelles approached the table and stared hard at the book.
"It is a little longer than it was, perhaps," he said. "I do not think so," said Drawlight. "It is tan leather now," said Lascelles. "Was it blue before?" "No," said Drawlight. "It was always tan."
Mr. Norrell laughed out loud. Mr. Norrell, who rarely even smiled, laughed at them.
"No, no, gentlemen. You have not guessed it. Indeed, you have not. Oh, Mr. Strange, I cannot tell you how much, but they do not understand what it is you have done. Pick it up," he cried. "Pick it up, Mr. Lascelles."
More puzzled than ever, Lascelles put out his hand to grasp the book. But all he grasped was the empty air. The book lay there in appearance only.
"He has made the book and its reflection change places," said Mr. Norrell. "The real book is over there, in the mirror."
And he went to peer into the mirror with an appearance of great professional interest.
"But how did you do it?"
How indeed? Murmured Strange. He walked about the room, examining the reflection of the book upon the table from different angles, like a billiards player closing one eye and then the other.
Can you get it back? Asked Drawlight.
Sadly, no, said Strange. To own the truth, he said at last, I've only the haziest notion of what I did. I dare say it's just the same with you, sir. One has a sensation like music playing at the back of one's head. One simply knows what the next note will be.
Quite remarkable, said Mr. Norrell.
What was perhaps rather more remarkable was that Mr. Norrell, who had lived all his life in fear of one day discovering a rival, had finally seen another man's magic, and far from being crushed by the sight, found himself elated by it. Mr. Norrell and Mr. Strange parted that afternoon on very cordial terms, and upon the following morning met again without Mr. Lascelles or Mr. Drawlight knowing anything about it. This meeting ended in Mr. Norrell's offering to take Mr. Strange as a pupil. Mr. Strange accepted.
I only wish that he had not married, said Mr. Norrell fretfully. Magicians have no business marrying.
Chapter 25 The Education of a Magician, September to December, 1809. On the first morning of Strange's education, he was invited to an early breakfast at Hanover Square. As the two magicians sat down at the breakfast table, Mr. Norrell said,
I have taken the liberty of drawing up a plan of study for you for the next 3 or 4 years.
Strange looked a little startled at the mention of 3 or 4 years, but he said nothing.
3 or 4 years is such a very short time, continued Mr. Norrell with a sigh. That try as I cannot see that we will achieve very much.
He passed a dozen or so sheets of paper to Strange. Each sheet was covered in 3 columns of Mr. Norrell's small, precise handwriting. Each column contained a long list of different sorts of magic. Footnote 1. Naturally, Mr. Norrell based his syllabus upon the classifications contained in De Generibus Artium Magicarum Anglorum by Francis Sutton Grove. Strange looked them over and said there was more to learn than he had supposed.
Ah, I envy you, sir, said Mr. Norrell. Indeed I do. The practice of magic is full of frustrations and disappointments, but the study is a continual delight. All of England's great magicians are one's companions and guides. Steady labour is rewarded by increase of knowledge, and best of all, one need not so much as look upon another of one's fellow creatures from 1 month's end to the next if one does not wish it.
For a few moments, Mr. Norrell seemed lost in contemplation of this happy state. Then, rousing himself, he proposed that they deny themselves the pleasure of Strange's education no longer, but go immediately into the library to begin. Mr. Norrell's library was on the first floor. It was a charming room in keeping with the tastes of its owner, who would always choose to come here for both solace and recreation. Mr. Drawlight had persuaded Mr. Norrell to adopt the fashion of setting small pieces of mirror into odd corners and angles. This meant that one was constantly meeting with a bright gleam of silver light or the sudden reflection of someone in the street where one least expected it. The walls were covered with a light green paper with a pattern of green oak leaves and knobbly oak twigs, and there was a little dome set into the ceiling which was painted to represent the leafy canopy of a glade in spring. The books all had matching bindings of pale calf leather with their titles stamped in neat silver capitals on the spine. Among all this elegance and harmony, it was somewhat surprising to observe so many gaps among the books and so many shelves entirely empty. Strange and Mr. Norrell seated themselves one on each side of the fire.
If you will permit me, sir, said Strange, I should like to begin by putting some questions to you. I confess that what I heard the other day concerning fairy spirits entirely astonished me, and I wondered if I might prevail upon you to talk to me a little upon this subject. To what dangers does the magician expose himself in employing fairy spirits, and what is your opinion of their utility?
Their utility has been greatly exaggerated, the danger much underestimated, said Mr. Norrell.
Oh, is it your opinion that fairies are, as some people think, demons? Asked Strange.
Upon the contrary, I am quite certain that the common view of them is the correct one.
Do you know the writings of Chaston upon the subject? It would not surprise me if Chaston turned out to have come very near the truth of it.
Footnote 2. Richard Chaston, 1620-95. Chaston wrote that men and fairies both contain within them a faculty of reason and a faculty of magic. In men, reason is strong and magic is weak. With fairies, it is the other way around. Magic comes very naturally to them, but by human standards, they are barely sane.
No, no, no. My objection to fairies is quite another thing. Mr. Strange, tell me, in your opinion, why does so much English magic depend, or appear to depend, upon the aid of fairy spirits?
Strange thought a moment.
I suppose because all English magic comes from the Raven King, who was educated at a fairy court and learned his magic there.
I agree that the Raven King has everything to do with it, said Mr. Norrell. Not, I think, in the way you suppose. Consider, if you will, Mr. Strange, that all the time the Raven King ruled Northern England, he also ruled a fairy kingdom. Consider, if you will, that no king ever had two such diverse races under his sway. Consider, if you will, that he was as great a king as he was a magician, a fact which almost all historians are prone to overlook. I think there can be little doubt that he was much preoccupied with the task of binding his two peoples together, a task which he accomplished, Mr. Strange, by deliberately exaggerating the role of fairies in magic. In this way, he increased his human subjects' esteem for fairies. He provided his fairy subjects with useful occupation, and made both peoples desire each other's company.
Yes, said Strange thoughtfully. I see that.
It seems to me, continued Mr. Norrell, that even the greatest of Orient magicians miscalculated the extent to which fairies are necessary to human magic. Oh, look at Pale. He considered his fairy servants so essential to the pursuit of his art that he wrote that his greatest treasures were the three or four fairy spirits living in his house. Yet my own example makes it plain that almost all respectable sorts of magic are perfectly achievable without assistance from anyone. What have I ever done that has needed the help of a fairy?
I understand you, said Strange, who imagined that Mr. Norrell's last question must be rhetorical. And I must confess, sir, that this idea is quite new to me. I've never seen it in any book.
Well, neither have I, said Mr. Norrell. Of course, there are some sorts of magic which are entirely impossible without fairies. There may be times, and I sincerely hope that such occasions will be rare, when you and I shall have to treat with those pernicious creatures. Naturally, we shall have to exercise the greatest caution. Any fairy we summon will almost certainly have dealt with English magicians before. He will be eager to recount for us all the names of the great magicians he has served, and the services he has rendered to each. He will understand the forms and precedents of such dealings a great deal better than we do. It puts us, will put us, at a disadvantage. I assure you, Mr. Strange, nowhere is the decline of English magic better understood than in the other lands.
Yet fairy spirits hold a great fascination for ordinary people, mused Strange. And perhaps if you were occasionally to employ one in your work, it might help make our art more popular. There is still a great deal of prejudice against using magic in the war.
Oh, indeed, cried Mr. Norrell irritably. People believe that magic begins and ends with fairies. They scarcely consider the skill and learning of the magician at all. No, Mr. Strange, that is no argument with me for employing fairies. Rather, the reverse. 100 years ago, the Magua historian, Valentine Mundy, denied that the other lands existed. He thought that the men who claimed to have been there were all liars. In this he was quite wrong, but his position remains one with which I have a great deal of sympathy, and I wish we could make it more generally believed.
Of course, said Mr. Norrell thoughtfully.
Mundy went on to deny that America existed, and then France, and so on. I believe that by the time he died, he had long since given up Scotland, and was beginning to entertain doubts of Carlyle. I have his book here.
Footnote 3. The Blue Book. Being an attempt to expose the most prevalent lies and common deceptions practiced by English magicians upon the king's subjects and upon each other. By Valentine Mundy. Published 1698. Mr. Norrell stood up and fetched it from the shelves. But he did not give it to Strange straight away. After a short silence,
Strange said. You advise me to read this book?
Well, yes, indeed. I think you should read it, said Mr. Norrell.
Strange waited, but Norrell continued to gaze at the book in his hand, as though he were entirely at a loss as to how to proceed. Then you must give it to me, sir, said Strange gently.
Yes, indeed, said Mr. Norrell.
He approached Strange cautiously and held the book out for several moments before suddenly tipping it up and off into Strange's hand with an odd gesture, as though it was not a book at all, but a small bird which clung to him and would on no account go to anyone else, so that he was obliged to trick it into leaving his hand. He was so intent upon this maneuver that fortunately he did not look up at Strange, who was trying not to laugh. Mr. Norrell remained a moment, looking wistfully at his book in another magician's hand. But once he had parted with one book, the painful part of his ordeal seemed to be over. Half an hour later, he recommended another book to Strange, and went and got it with scarcely any fuss. By midday, he was pointing out books on the shelves to Strange and allowing him to fetch them down for himself. By the end of the day, Mr. Norrell had given Strange a quite extraordinary number of books to read, and said that he expected him to have read them by the end of the week. A whole day of conversation and study was a luxury they could not often afford. Generally, they were obliged to spend some part of every day in attending to Mr. Norrell's visitors, whether these were the fashionable people whom Mr. Norrell still believed it essential to cultivate, or gentlemen from the various government departments. By the end of a fortnight, Mr. Norrell's enthusiasm for his new pupil knew no bounds.
One has but to explain something to him once, Norrell told Sir Walter, and he understands it immediately. I well remember how many weeks I labored to comprehend Pale's conjectures concerning foreshadowing of things to come, yet Mr. Strange was master of this exceptionally difficult theory in little more than 4 hours.
Sir Walter smiled.
No doubt, but I think you rate your own achievements too low. Mr. Strange has the advantage of a teacher to explain the difficult parts to him, whereas you had none. You have prepared the way for him and made everything smooth and easy.
Ah, cried Mr. Norrell, but when Mr. Strange and I sat down to talk of the conjectures some more, I realized that they had a much wider application than I had supposed. It was his questions, you see, which led me to a new understanding of Dr. Pales's ideas.
Sir Walter said,
Well, sir, I am glad that you have found a friend whose mind accords so well with your own. There is no greater comfort.
I agree with you, Sir Walter, cried Mr. Norrell. Indeed I do.
Strange's admiration for Mr. Norrell was of a more restrained nature. Norrell's dull conversation and oddities of behaviour continued to grate upon his nerves, and at about the same time as Mr. Norrell was praising Strange to Sir Walter, Strange was complaining of Norrell to Arabella. Even now I scarcely know what to make of him. He is at one and the same time the most remarkable man of the age, and the most tedious. Twice this morning our conversation was interrupted because he thought he heard a mouse in the room. Mice are a particular aversion of his. 2 footmen, 2 maids and I moved all the furniture about looking for the mouse, while he stood by the fireplace rigid with fear.
Has he a cat? Suggested Arabella.
He should get a cat. Oh, but that is quite impossible. He hates cats even more than mice. He told me that if he's ever so unlucky as to find himself in the same room as a cat, then he's sure to be all over red pimples within an hour. It was Mr. Norrell's sincere wish to educate his pupil thoroughly, but the habits of secrecy and dissimulation which he had cultivated all his life were not easily thrown off. On a day in December, when snow was falling in large, soft flakes from heavy greenish-gray clouds, the 2 magicians were seated in Mr. Norrell's library. The slow, drifting motion of the snow outside the windows, the heat of the fire, and the effects of a large glass of sherry wine, which he had been so ill-advised as to accept when Mr. Norrell offered it, all combined to make Strange very heavy and sleepy. His head was supported upon his hand, and his eyes were almost closing. Mr. Norrell was speaking.
Many magicians, he said, steepling his hands, have attempted to confine magical powers in some physical object. It's not a difficult operation, and the object can be anything the magician wishes. Trees, jewels, books, bullets, hats have all been employed for this purpose at one time or another. Mr. Norrell frowned hard at his fingertips. By placing some of his power in whatever object he chooses,
The magician hopes to make himself secure from those wanings of power which are the inevitable result of illness and old age. I myself have often been severely tempted to do it. My own skills can be quite overturned by a heavy cold or a bad sore throat. Yet after careful consideration, I have concluded that such divisions of power are most ill-advised. Let us examine the case of rings. Rings have long been considered peculiarly suitable for this sort of magic, by virtue of their small size. A man may keep a ring continually upon his finger for years without exciting the smallest comment, which would not be the case if he showed the same attachment to a book or a pebble. And yet there is scarcely a magician in history who, having once committed some of his skill and power to a magic ring, did not somehow lose that ring and was put to a world of trouble to get it back again. Take, for example, the 12th-century master of Nottingham, whose daughter mistook his ring of power for a common bauble, put it on her finger, and went to St. Matthew's Fair. This negligent young woman—
"What?" cried Strange suddenly.
"What?" echoed Mr. Norrell, startled.
Strange gave the other gentleman a sharp, questioning look. Mr. Norrell gazed back at him, a little frightened.
"I beg your pardon, sir," said Strange. "But do I understand you aright? Are we speaking of magical powers that are got by some means into rings, stones, amulets, things of that sort?"
Mr. Norrell nodded cautiously.
"But I thought you said," said Strange, "that is," he made some effort to speak more gently, "I thought that you told me some weeks ago that magic rings and stones were a fable."
Mr. Norrell stared at his pupil in alarm.
"But perhaps I was mistaken," said Strange.
Mr. Norrell said nothing at all.
"I was mistaken," said Strange again.
"I beg your pardon, sir, for interrupting you. Pray, continue."
But Mr. Norrell, though he appeared greatly relieved that Strange had resolved the matter, was no longer equal to continuing, and instead proposed that they had some tea, to which Mr. Strange agreed very readily. Footnote 4. The story of the Master of Nottingham's daughter, to which Mr. Norrell never returned, is worth recounting, and so I set it down here. The fair to which the young woman repaired was held on St. Matthew's Feast in Nottingham. She spent a pleasant day going about among the booths, making purchases of linens, laces, and spices. Sometime during the afternoon, she happened to turn suddenly to see some Italian tumblers who were behind her, and the edge of her cloak flew out and struck a passing goose. This bad-tempered fowl ran at her, flapping its wings and screaming. In her surprise, she dropped her father's ring, which fell into the goose's open gullet, and the goose, in its surprise, swallowed it. But before the Master of Nottingham's daughter could say or do anything, the goose herd drove the goose on, and both disappeared into the crowd. The goose was bought by a man called John Ford, who took it back to his house in the village of Fiskerton, and the next day his wife, Margaret Ford, killed the goose, plucked it, and drew out its innards. In its stomach she found a heavy silver ring set with a crooked piece of yellow amber. She put it down on a table near three hen's eggs that had been gathered that morning. Immediately the eggs began to shake, and then to crack open, and from each egg something marvellous appeared. From the first egg came a stringed instrument, like a viol, except that it had little arms and legs, and played sweet music upon itself with a tiny bow. From the next egg emerged a ship of purest ivory, with sails of fine white linen and a set of silver oars. And from the last egg hatched a chick with strange red and gold plumage. This last was the only wonder to survive beyond the day. After an hour or two, the vial cracked like an eggshell and fell into pieces, and by sunset the ivory ship had set sail and rowed away through the air. But the bird grew up and later started a fire which destroyed most of Grantham. During the conflagration, it was observed bathing itself in the flames. From this circumstance, it was presumed to be a phoenix. When Margaret Ford realized that a magic ring had somehow fallen into her possession, she was determined to do magic with it. Unfortunately, she was a thoroughly malicious woman, who tyrannized over her gentle husband and spent long hours pondering how to revenge herself upon her enemies. John Ford held the manor of Fiskerton, and in the months that followed he was loaded with lands and riches by greater lords who feared his wife's wicked magic. Word of the wonders performed by Margaret Ford
soon reached Nottingham, where the Master of Nottingham lay in bed, waiting to die. So much of his power had gone into the ring that the loss of it had made him first melancholy, then despairing, and finally sick. When news of his ring finally came, he was too ill to do anything about it. His daughter, on the other hand, was thoroughly sorry for bringing this misfortune on her family, and thought it her duty to try and get the ring back. So, without telling anyone what she intended, she set off along the riverbank to the village of Fiskerton. She had only got as far as Gunthorpe when she came upon a very dreadful sight. A little wood was burning steadily with fierce flames lapping every part of it. The black, bitter smoke made her eyes sting and her throat ache, yet the wood was not consumed by the fire. A low moan issued from the trees, as if they cried out at such unnatural torment. The master's daughter looked round for someone to explain this wonder to her. A young woodsman who was passing told her. 2 weeks ago, Margaret Ford stopped in the wood on the road from Thurcoton. She rested under the shade of its branches, drank from its stream, and ate its nuts and berries. But just as she was leaning, a root caught her foot and made her fall, and when she rose from the ground, a briar was so impertinent as to scratch her arm. So she cast a spell upon the wood and swore it would burn for ever. The master's daughter thanked him for the information and walked on for a while. She became thirsty and crouched down to scoop up some water from the river. All at once a woman, or something very like a woman, half rose out of the water. There were fish scales all over her body. Her skin was as grey and spotted as a trout's, and her hair had become an odd arrangement of spiny grey trout fins. She seemed to glare at the master's daughter, but her round cold fish eyes and stiff fish skin were not well adapted to reproduce human expressions, and so it was hard to tell. "Oh, I beg your pardon," said the master's daughter, startled. The woman opened her mouth, showing a fish throat and a mouth full of ugly fish teeth, but she seemed unable to make a sound. Then she rolled over and plunged back into the water. A woman who was washing clothes on the riverbank explained to the master's daughter, "That is Jocelyn Trent, who is so unfortunate as to be the wife of a man that Margaret Ford likes. Out of jealousy, Margaret Ford has cast a spell on her, and she has forced, poor lady, to spend all her days and nights immersed in the shallows of the river to keep her enchanted skin and flesh from drying out. And as she cannot swim, she lives in constant terror of drowning." The master's daughter thanked the woman for telling her this. Next, the master's daughter came to the village of Hoveringham. A man and his wife, who were both squeezed together atop a little pony, advised her not to enter the village, but led her around it by narrow lanes and paths. From a little green knoll, the master's daughter looked down and saw that everyone in the village wore a thick blindfold round his eyes. They were not at all used to their self-created blindness and constantly banged their faces against walls, tripped over stools and carts, cut themselves on knives and tools, and burnt themselves in the fire. As a consequence, they were covered in gashes and wounds. Yet not one of them removed his blindfold. "Oh," said the wife, "the priest of Hoveringham has been bold enough to denounce the wickedness of Margaret Ford from his pulpit. Bishops, abbots, and canons have all been silent, but this frail old man defied her, and so she has cursed the whole village. It is their fate to have vivid images of all their worst fears constantly before their eyes. These poor souls see their children starve, their parents go mad, their loved ones scorn and betray them. Wives and husbands see each other horribly murdered. And so, though these sights may be naught but illusions, the villagers must blindfold themselves, or else be driven mad by what they see." Shaking her head over the appalling wickedness of Margaret Ford, the master's daughter continued on her way to John Ford's manor, where she found Margaret and her maidservants, each with a wooden stick in her hand, driving the cows to their evening's milking. The master's daughter went boldly up to Margaret Ford. Upon the instant, Margaret Ford turned and struck her with a stick. "Wicked girl," she cried, "I know who you are. My ring has told me. I know that you plan to lie to me, who have never done you any harm at all, and ask to become my servant. I know that you plan to steal my ring. Well, know this. I have set strong spells upon my ring. If any thief were foolish enough to touch it, then within a very short space of time, bees and wasps and all kinds of insects would fly up from the earth and sting him. Eagles and hawks and all kinds of birds would fly down from the sky and peck at him.
Then bears and boars and all kinds of wild creatures would appear and tear and trample him to pieces.
Then Margaret Ford beat the master's daughter soundly and told the maids to put her to work in the kitchen. Margaret Ford's servants, a miserable, ill-treated lot, gave the master's daughter the hardest work to do, and whenever Margaret Ford beat them or raged at them, which happened very often, they relieved their feelings by doing the same to her. Yet the master's daughter did not allow herself to become low-spirited. She stayed working in the kitchen for several months, and thought very hard how she might trick Margaret Ford into dropping the ring or losing it. Margaret Ford was a cruel woman, quick to take offense, and her anger, once roused, could never be appeased. But for all that, she adored little children. She took every opportunity to nurse babies, and once she had a child in her arms, she was gentleness itself. She had no child of her own, and no one who knew her doubted that this was a source of great sorrow to her. It was widely supposed that she had expended a great deal of magic upon trying to conceive a child, but without success. One day, Margaret Ford was playing with a neighbor's little girl, and saying how if she were ever to have a child, then she would rather it were a girl, and how she would wish it to have a creamy white skin and green eyes and copper curls, this being Margaret Ford's own coloring.
"Oh," said the master's daughter innocently, "the wife of the Reeve in Epperston has a baby of exactly that description, the prettiest little creature that ever you saw."
Then Margaret Ford made the master's daughter take her to Epperston and show her the Reeve's wife's baby. And when Margaret Ford saw that the baby was indeed the sweetest, prettiest child that ever there was, just as the master's daughter had said, she announced to the horrified mother her intention of taking the child away with her. As soon as she had possession of the Reeve's wife's baby, Margaret Ford became almost a different person. She spent her days in looking after the baby, playing with her and singing to her. Margaret Ford became contented with her lot. She used her magic ring a great deal less than she had before, and scarcely ever lost her temper. So things went on, until the master of Nottingham's daughter had lived in Margaret Ford's house for almost a year. Then, one summer's day, Margaret Ford, the master's daughter, the baby, and the other maids took their midday meal upon the banks of the river. After eating, Margaret Ford rested in the shade of a rose bush. It was a hot day, and they were all very sleepy. As soon as she was certain that Margaret Ford was asleep, the master's daughter took out a sugar plum and showed it to the baby. The baby, knowing only too well what should be done to sugar plums, opened its mouth wide, and the master's daughter popped it in. Then, as quick as she could, and making sure that none of the other maids saw what she did, she slipped the magic ring from Margaret Ford's finger. Then,
"Oh, oh," she cried, "wake up, madam. The baby has taken your ring and put it in her mouth. Oh, for the dear child's sake, undo the spell, undo the spell."
Margaret Ford awoke and saw the baby with its cheek bulging out. But for the moment, she was too sleepy and surprised to understand what was happening. A bee flew past, and the master's daughter pointed at it and screamed. All the other maids screamed too.
"Quickly, madam, I beg you," cried the master's daughter. "Oh," she looked up, "here are the eagles and hawks approaching. Oh," she looked into the distance, "here are the bears and boars running to tear the poor little thing to pieces."
Margaret Ford cried out to the ring to stop the magic, which it did immediately. And almost at the same moment, the baby swallowed the sugar plum. While Margaret Ford and the maids begged and coaxed the baby and shook it to make it cough up the magic ring, the master of Nottingham's daughter began to run along the riverbank towards Nottingham. The rest of the story has all the usual devices. As soon as Margaret Ford discovered how she'd been tricked, she fetched horses and dogs to chase the master's daughter. Upon several occasions, the master's daughter seemed lost for sure. The riders were almost upon her, and the dogs just behind her. But the story tells how she was helped by all the victims of Margaret Ford's magic, how the villagers of Hoveringham tore off their blindfolds, and in spite of all the horrifying sights they saw, rushed to build barricades to prevent Margaret Ford from passing. How poor Jocelyn Trent reached up out of the river and tried to pull Margaret Ford down into the muddy water. How the burning wood threw down flaming branches upon her. The ring was returned to the master of Nottingham, who undid all the wrongs Margaret Ford had perpetrated, and restored his own fortune and reputation. There is another version of this story which contains no magic ring, no eternal burning wood, no phoenix, no miracles at all, in fact. According to this version, Margaret Ford and the master of Nottingham's daughter
whose name was Donata Toro, were not enemies at all, but the leaders of a fellowship of female magicians that flourished in Nottinghamshire in the 12th century. Hugh Toril, the master of Nottingham, opposed the fellowship and took great pains to destroy it, though his own daughter was a member. He very nearly succeeded until the women left their homes and fathers and husbands and went to live in the woods under the protection of Thomas Godbless, a much greater magician than Hugh Toril. This less colourful version of the story has never been as popular as the other, but it is this version which Jonathan Strange said was the true one, and which he included in the History and Practice of English Magic.